Are you going to catch us on that middle camera if we're... And do we need to get closer or... All right, why don't we... Yeah. Are we ready? Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started now. My name is Pavel Ogren. I'm the general manager for the Oceano Community Services District.
And I'm John Greaser. I work for the county in the Planning and Building Department.
And tonight's community outreach event is really being co-hosted by the Oceano Community Services District and the County Energy Group within the Planning Department of the County of San Luis Obispo. Real quickly, I want to make sure that I recognize that there's a number of board of directors, your elected officials from Oceano. Shirley Gibson is walking in right here. Karen White, our president, was at the board up front. Director Cynthia Replogle is here, if I see a wave of a hand, maybe over here in this corner. And then Aileen Villa is here as well in the back in the center. I want to make sure to recognize all of our board members. The purpose, first and foremost, of our meeting today is really to do community outreach and to introduce the community to a lot of the different agencies and individuals who are working on behalf of Oceano. As an unincorporated community, unlike a city, where cities tend to do most everything within their boundaries, a community like Oceano has a lot of different agencies serving them, including private nonprofits, and some of our utilities are here.
So we wanted to make sure we covered housekeeping quickly. The exits are behind you, to your left and your right. We also have bathrooms. If you go through the main lobby here, right by the sign-in table. If in case of an emergency, we encourage folks to go out one of these exits and go across the street to the other side of 19th Street. We're going to do a little bit of acknowledgments quickly, particularly around what the funding that makes this possible.
Yeah, for Oceano, we have had a significant funding that has been awarded to us. Today's events, in part, have been funded by the California Department of Water Resources, as well as the California State Water Resources Control Board. In cooperation with PG&E, we've also gotten some additional funding for today's event.
Speaking on behalf of energy programs, some of the initiatives I will be speaking today about enjoy funding from the California Energy Commission, as well as, frankly, from all of you as ratepayers. We also have some other grant funding that I'll talk about later.
Thanks, John. And so today's event is formatted where we have a number of speakers here. And a lot of the topics that are going to be presented on the slideshows or with PowerPoint relate to community decisions that are going to be coming up in 2019. So it's a preview on some of these topics. And then during 2019, there will be follow-up community meetings on the details prior to any action by the Board of Directors. At this point in time, John's got another comment.
I think Pablo was going to grab the agenda, and I encourage everyone to take a look at it really quickly. We wanted to describe how today is organized, give you a bit of an overview. So it's thematic. So the concept today is that the event and the speakers and the different tables around the periphery of the room are organized by four topics or themes. Those are water, energy, infrastructure, and planning. That's really what folks are going to speak about today, and that's what the tables are organized around. If you take a look at your agenda, the other thing I wanted to call your attention to is that we're going to have, a ping-pong effect where we're going to have two speakers, and during that time period, we encourage everybody, including all of our tabling participants today, to come sit in these chairs here and at the round tables. We're basically discouraging folks from visiting the tables while presenters are speaking. So we're going to have two speakers, and then we're going to take a break and have an open house where we encourage everyone to not only visit the 15 or so tables today, but also go outside, grab a coffee, check out the fire truck, shoot some hoops, etc., mingle. And then come back in. We're going to have three more presenters where we encourage everyone to sit down in the center. And then we'll go back again to that open house format where we encourage our tablers to go back to their tables and for event attendees to go and speak and learn about the various programs and topics being discussed today. So hopefully that's clear by looking at your agenda. Before we go on, and I hand the mic back to Paavo, I just wanted again to thank you all very much, those of you who came to present, to participate, and most specifically those of you who came to attend the event and learn about the really exciting stuff going on in this community.
Thank you, John, and I also want to make sure to extend my appreciation for everybody here today. So our first presenter is going to be covering the hazard mitigation planning for the Oceano Community Services District. This was brought is funded from a federal emergency management agency, FEMA, and the California Department of Emergency Services. Bob Newman, everybody's got biographies on the back, is the executive vice president of Category 5, have done numerous plans of this nature and others, more than 30 local and 10 multi-hazard emergency spots, and was previously San Luis Obispo's fire chief from 1991 and 2002, which was the time period I first met Bob, and I'm looking forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Paavo.
And the floor is yours.
Great. And do we have a clicker?
Yes.
Okay. And to move it forward, we probably don't touch. It says don't touch. What does that mean?
and we've got page down there. Could probably
okay,
work too.
Work.
And then in the event that you want the
all
pointer.
Right, Bob, what's the deal? That's the one that's labeled don't touch.
You know, so I'm going to use that for yes, Q&A.
And I'll need you to speak into the microphone for the record for posterity, Bob. Yes, see you later.
Is there another hand mic?
There is a wireless mic if you would like it. I'm getting you on this camera, so I need you to be in this general area. Would you like the wireless mic, Bob?
I would.
Paavo has it. He's going to bring it over.
So I'll wait just a minute while everybody kind of huddles up here. It's nice and warm and toasty in here. We can gather, maybe we can generate some heat. Okay. Yeah, gotcha. These guys are all real technical here. Yes. Okay, well, good morning and welcome to you all. As Paavo indicated, we are a local firm here in San Luis Obispo County known as Category 5. We've been writing hazard mitigation plans and disaster plans and a variety of emergency response training programs for cities and counties throughout the state of California for about 16 years now. So as Paavo alluded, the district went out and received a grant about 2 years ago to develop a hazard mitigation plan for the community, and our firm was successful in bidding and was awarded that contract. So what is hazard mitigation planning? Hazard mitigation planning simply has to do with taking a really deep look at a community and trying to figure out what their vulnerabilities are and how we can go about minimizing the cost of natural disasters when they occur within a community. And we know that within the United States today, we have had can you all see that? It doesn't come across very well, does it? But what you see here are a variety of disasters that have struck the nation this year. It's the flooding in the North Carolina and South Carolina. It's the hurricanes that we've just recently experienced in the South. And then the bottom picture, you can't read the writing, but is of the car fire that recently struck, both the car and the Tubbs fire that recently struck in Northern California. Even since this slide was put together, we've had now another significant fire, in fact, the most destructive fire that the California has ever experienced, which is the campfire in Paradise, with almost 10,000 homes or structures lost. So what a hazard mitigation plan does is it looks very deeply into a community and tries to determine what are the things that we can do to make that community much better prepared to suffer the consequences of some sort of a natural disaster. Another important component of the plan is that it satisfies a requirement by the federal government that, one, you have the plan that outlines where to go, and then it makes available for the community grants and funding for improvements to the system. So that's the purpose of a hazard mitigation plan. And what we do, as I indicated, we take a really deep look at a community. What services does the district provide? And we know that here, you know, it's water, fire, those sorts of things. We take a look at the government, how the community is structured, what its relationship is to the other government agencies surrounding it. We look at the demographics. Is this an older community like Cambria, or is it a younger community like Oceano? We look at the housing. We review the housing element and everything that's involved in that. Is there a lot of open space? All those sorts of things for land use. Big recreational components here. We also look at the economy. What can this district afford to do in the way of preparation? We look at the climate. What are the climatic impacts? Is this community at significant risk for wildfire? Not really. You're right on the ocean. You don't really have a whole lot of vegetation surrounding you of consequence, so your wildfire threat is fairly minimized. And then we look at the health index. How healthy is this community? So those are the things that we look at, and then we do what we call a risk assessment. We very carefully go back in time, and here we've had a lot of help from the Telegram Tribune, past county records. Karen White, your board president, is also quite the historian, was able to help us a lot. But we look at the history of the hazards that have impacted the community. We look at the extent and the possible potentials. We also review the cascading effects so that we know that if you flood the downtown, is there an impact? Obviously, the flooding is a huge concern, but then, does it also then impact the transportation mechanisms? Is your fire agency be able to get in and out of the community with flooding? All those various things. And this is being problematic. Okay. I love this technical stuff, especially when these two gentlemen are here to solve it and I don't have to worry for it. I will also share with you that as we go through today and we talk a little bit about the plan, when we go to the breakout, you know, the plan is a really large, deep, complex plan. It's about 150 pages long. I pretty much guarantee you if you have a hard time sleeping at night, you want to read that plan, it'll take you there. But we've very succinctly brought the plan down to just two or three pages of what's critically important, and we have that in the back of the room for you. So, again, we assess the vulnerability. You know, where are the vulnerable issues that can impact the community? Okay. Then we look at the capability of the district to go out and solve some of those problems. Okay. Do they have the legal authority to do it? Do they have the regulatory processes? And we know that's a huge thing these days because the community of Oceano just can't act on its own when it goes to deal with, say, the creek, because the creek just doesn't start in Oceano and end in Oceano. It starts way back up in the Santa Lucias, comes down, and there's a number of agencies that have regulatory power and authority there. So we have to review all of those things. Does the district have the administrative skill sets? In other words, do they have the capability to actually carry out some of the projects that we recommend? Do they have the technical expertise? Do they have the financial capability? And we know that all of our communities now are really struggling for financial issues. So it doesn't make any sense for us to go out and, you know, just sort of pie in the sky, if you will, a whole bunch of things that we'd love to see happen when we know that financially those things are not going to be available to us. And is there the political will of the community to resolve some of these issues? So, for example, if I wrote in the plan that I thought the thing that we should do would be to just take gunite and completely gunite the creek all the way from the Lopez Dam all the way down to the ocean, do you think the political will would stand for that? No, I don't think so. So we have to be realistic.
All of these things come together as we review the capability of the district to carry out the goals. Now, what we have done over a period of about a year now is put together seven very succinct goals that we've reviewed not only with Paavo and his group, but with some of the surrounding agencies, and with also a planning group that we put together that we have been working with here in the community. The first goal is to go about and promote an understanding and support for hazard mitigation by key stakeholders and the public within the community. Goal number two is to ensure that future development is protected from natural disasters. Goal number three is to build and support local capacity and commitment to minimize the district's vulnerability to potentially naturally occurring hazards. Goal number four, then, is to minimize the level of damage and loss to people, existing and future critical facilities and infrastructure due to flooding. Goal number five is to minimize the level of damage and losses to people and existing critical infrastructures due to earthquake. Goal number six, limit risk to and the impacts from hazardous material spills, sewage spills, illegal disposals, transportation accidents, or system failures. And then goal number seven is to minimize the level of damage and losses to people and existing critical infrastructure due to a tsunami event. So we put together, I know that picture kind of, I look at that picture, I think to myself, how realistic is that? So we develop these seven goals, and then behind each of these goals is an objective. So we have 14 various objectives, and then we have 55 various mitigation actions that we propose over the next 5 years in a very thoughtful process we hope to accomplish. Not only do we outline what they are, but we outline who is responsible for getting them done and how we propose that those things be paid for. And as I talked about earlier, you know, it would be great if there was just pie in the sky and we could just reach out and grab a big bucket of money. That's not going to happen. So we have to very thoughtfully go through and figure out what is actually attainable and what is not. And as I indicate, we do this for a period of over 5 years because we know we can't get everything done at once. And then in 5 years, the federal government requires that we go back and readjust and edit the plan moving out to the next 5 years. So when we do this prioritization, we look at the probability of the hazard occurring, what is the effectiveness of the mitigation actions that we propose, again, what is the practicality of the mitigation actions for the jurisdictions? Is it going to be socially acceptable? Is it technically acceptable? Do we have the administrative, the political, the legal, and the economic and environmental wherewithal to accomplish the mitigation actions? So, packaging all that together, we put together a mitigation action plan, if you will. And that's the little handout that I have in the back of the room that we can actually share with you today. And that's how we approach this process. And as we do, we're now in the approval process. The plan has been reviewed by a number of technical experts throughout the, you know, the various subject matter experts, if you will. It will now go to FEMA for its initial approval, and once FEMA approves it, then we will bring it back to the district board for its final approval. We've enjoyed working with the staff in the district and the various technical experts that they have, and as we close, I'd be happy to have you back and talk about the mitigation action plan that we've put together and any other questions that you might have. The plan is currently available for your review on the website, on the district's website. Thank you all.
So we have enough time for, if anybody has any questions right now, we can have about 3 to 5 minutes of questions, and then we'll have our next speaker.
Oh, I like to yell. Hello. Do you have funding yet?
The plan is fully funded.
Okay, and when and where will you get started?
Use this, that'd be great.
So the plan is fully funded. We are in process. I would say technically we've already started. But in reality, it still needs to go to FEMA for its final approval. And then once FEMA approves it, it comes back to the board. There are a variety of funding mechanisms that we identify in the plan, you know, as to how they're going to be accomplished. Some of it's volunteer, some of it's grant, some of it's district funds. Again, there's no pie in the sky for this sort of thing. We just very thoughtfully go through and think about, okay, how are we going to approach these things? Some of them are no-cost items. Some of them are rather expensive. So, does that answer your question?
Mama. Where's the first area where you will start, like, making improvements, like actual physical land area in Oceano?
Well, obviously, one of the higher priorities is the flooding, and that's an ongoing thing. But there are a number of mechanisms already in place. There's a whole infrastructure study that's currently in process that Pablo can talk to, that we're talking about how we prioritize some of the improvements to water lines and sewer lines so that if we have an earthquake, you know, that they're not damaged. So I can't point to one specific thing because there are so many things. Public education is a large component of what the plan attempts to do, and we've already started some of those things.
Yeah. Is this one on? Just real quickly, I saw another question up here that I'm going to have. But some of the question on the physical improvements really relates to the subsequent speakers. So,
do you consider sea level rise as a risk to our beach community?
We do. We talk about it in the plan.
Oh, thank
you. Are very fortunate to be protected by the sand dunes. That is not the case, and I wrote the hazard mitigation plan, not the current hazard mitigation plan, but the original hazard mitigation plan for the community, or for Cambria. Oh. And a lot of that community is a lot lower.
Oh.
But here you're fortunate in as much as that the sand dunes protect you. Now, obviously, there is the breach of Arroyo Grande Creek, and water could flow back the Arroyo Grande Creek.
Oh.
But we do discuss some of the mechanisms to protect the sanitation plant back there. And that's
so
currently in process.
You did write in your plan that our dunes are our protection against the sea level rise.
Yes.
Well, thank you so very much,
sir. Okay.
Hi. You had mentioned a community district website. I just wanted to get that website URL from you.
Okay. Pavel, I don't know that off the top of your head. I assume it's just oceanocsd.com. Org?
Oceanocsd.org.
Where'd that go? Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for Bob?
So I know that things get done more efficiently and quickly when there's a public-private partnership. Oftentimes, are there things in a mitigation plan that might be this technical that the community can help and take on, or is it all things that we need to support government or work with government to accomplish?
That's a great question, and thank you. No, and I'll give you a primary example. One of the things that the district could use some help with is the development of its radio system. It's they've had struggles over the years, you know, financially for the radio system, and it's been allowed to languish. And so we made a proposal in there that they work with the Aries Races group, which is amateur radio group, if you will. Those folks just love to be involved and engaged in those sort of things. And so that's what our recommendation. And I know when we go to approach the Aries radio group, in fact, we've already chatted with them, that's just a great example of a public-private, you know, community group effort to solve a problem. So,
anyone else? There'll be lots of opportunity for further questions afterwards, but okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. So I'd like to introduce our next speaker. If our audiovisual folks could help me with the next PowerPoint. And while they do that, Pablo Ogren is the general manager of the Oceano Community Services District. I think you all are familiar with him. So prior to his employment with the district, he was the director of the Department of Public Works for the County of San Luis Obispo. Pablo has been working on community-related finance, water resource, and infrastructure issues for over 30 years, which has included leadership roles on Lopez Water, the Nacimiento Water Project, and the State Water Project. His work with Oceano includes addressing long-term community needs for infrastructure repairs and replacement. He supports working with neighboring communities on solving groundwater management issues and continuing the success of the Five Cities Fire Authority. Pablo?
Thank you, John. For the presentation today that I'm going to be providing is going to be really on a couple of specific areas for Oceano Community Services District relating to our water resource reliability program. John had also mentioned the district has some other big issues coming forward in 2019, including the continuation of the Five Cities Fire Authority, and hopefully people will maintain engagement in that as well. A question that came up for Bob Newman was private-public partnerships and the provision for waste management and recycling in the community is a public-private partnership. In fact, it's public-private partnerships throughout the county of San Luis Obispo, where the local agencies like Oceano Community Services District have franchise agreements with our local waste companies. Waste Connections, Inc. is here today, and I encourage you to visit their table back. But it's through that public-private partnership that not only do we accomplish waste collection, but it also includes the composting and the recycling that's available throughout the county and the community. So there's a number of different areas that public-private partnerships can be pursued. And today, though, I'm going to focus in on water. The Water Resource Reliability Program itself is funded by the California Department of Water Resources, almost $200,000. We have some additional grant money that's coming forward to help with design work and moving that program forward. It has a couple of main components. One is the leak detection. We have some significant leaks within our water system. Portions of our water system are really pretty antiquated and have suffered from many, many years of deferred replacement projects. So that's the biggest component, is identifying leaks and figuring out what we're going to do in the future on those. In addition to the funding that's provided by the Department of Water Resources, the State Water Board also funded the California Rural Water Association to come out and do some specific leak detection efforts, where they take sounding equipment, they attach it to valves and different pipes throughout the street, and by listening to the movement of water, they can identify whether there's leaks in those pipes. So we knew we had some significant areas of problems. There was other areas where we weren't sure the extent of the problems, and California Rural Water helped us in that regard. Also, the groundwater recharge plan includes two different components, a low-impact development plan. The poster boards over at our table, as well as some of our handouts, address some of those concepts. As Bob mentioned, you know, if there was lots of money, we know we'd be able to pursue that. We're going to be going into that, but low-impact development concepts for groundwater recharge are going to be heavily dependent on any future grant money. And then recycle water injection, I'll be speaking very briefly. Later today, Ben Fine with the City of Pismo Beach Public Works will talk about the recycle water efforts of Central Coast Blue, and Oceano is certainly supporting those efforts. Oh, I want to also thank Megan Healy with KSBLI. She came out yesterday. I'm not sure if anybody caught it in the news last night. You can also go to the KSBY website. She has a article or a video, came out and interviewed us yesterday, so I told her it was only fair if we could take a picture of her as well, and that's at North Swing and Truman, where we do have an ongoing leak. It's an example of a 2-inch galvanized pipe, extremely small, that's been problematic. Our crews have been chasing leaks on that pipe for quite some time. And so that's one where the board in October approved moving forward with not just fixing the leaks, but repairing the pipelines in the street prior to the county coming in and doing, they're going to do the asphalt overlay on the roads in that specific location and others in the community in 2019. So that's under design right now, and we'll be bidding that out and having the lines replaced in the very near future. And I wanted to make sure to acknowledge Megan and the work that she's done to help cover the community issue. Briefly, I want to talk about the sources of supply of water for Oceano, because that is something that the community can and should be very proud of. Oceano has essentially the most reliable water supply in comparison to demand in the county of San Luis Obispo. We have three sources. Lopez water, picture I took during the drought when water levels are very low, and what you can see on the is the intake tower. So the different portals that would draw water out of the lake have been exposed in this picture. The lake was, you know, very low, and thankfully the rains a year and a half ago helped bring up water levels a little bit. But last week, the lake went back down below the 20,000 acre foot storage number, which is one of the triggers for conserving the water supplies out of Lopez. A community is also hooked up to the State Water Project, and even though the State Water Project on a statewide basis has a lot of reliability concerns, within San Luis Obispo County, it's actually very reliable because the county's allocation of the State Water Project is more than five times their delivery commitments. And because of that additional excess allocation of state water, Oceano has always been able to get 100% of its allocations. I want to be a little bit cautious because, just like the stock market, past performance is not always an indicator of the future. So we don't want to ever take anything too granted from a water supply standpoint. But certainly the State Water Project has been good for Oceano, and it's been expensive. The community is paying a lot of money for that water resource reliability and groundwater. The district also has pumping rights out of the Santa Maria groundwater basin. And although the basin levels have declined significantly, there's a lot of work going on in order to help address that. Overall, from Lopez, it's 303 acre-feet per year. An acre-foot of water will serve 2 to 4 families. A typical family in Oceano uses about amount of water that would fill up a 1,500-square-foot home. As a matter of perspective, the amount that a family would use in a year is approximately equal to, again, the amount that would fill up a 1,500-square-foot house. State Water Project, up to 750 acre-feet, groundwater, 900 acre-feet. So a total of up to, and I put up to because if we're in a drought or other conditions, then certainly those numbers can drop pretty significantly. How much do we use? As much as 929 acre-feet. That was back in 2011. Since then and during the drought, the community's demand has dropped by about 30% and has gotten down to about 663 acre-feet. And this is the graph that really shows consumption in comparison to the available supply. So the dotted line across the bottom represents the allocation of Lopez water. Add to it state water and we get up to the red dotted line. And then add to it groundwater and we get up to the blue. Again, in drought situations, those total supplies are going to be reduced. But we can see that even in the highest year, the community's supply was approximately, the community's demand was approximately half of the total potential available supply. And with the reduced consumption in the community, it's about a third. So there's a lot of room in there, and a general indication of the good situation from a water supply standpoint is that during the drought, the community was able to increase water in storage every year as opposed to having to draw water out of storage in order to get by. So overall, for Oceano water resource strategies, there's three primary ones that I'm going to address: storage. And throughout California, we know that we need storage in order to save the water that's developed during the wet years so that it's available then for the dry years. The Oceano CSD infrastructure, which is a lot of what the grant money is paying for, evaluating the system, identifying costs associated with repairing the leaky pipes, and improving stormwater recharge. And then the third is support Central Coast Blue, because Central Coast Blue is the wastewater reclamation project that will directly benefit the sustainability of the groundwater basin. So what about storage? Well, the number one thing is the Lopez supply contracts. So since the 1960s, the community has helped pay for Lopez Dam, in part to have a water allocation out of Lopez. Significant additional money was approved by voters around 2000 to do the earthquake retrofit of Lopez Dam. And the facility is there, but Oceano, Rio Grande, Grover, Pismo Beach, we have zero storage rights in there. So we get an annual allocation of water out of Lopez, but if we don't use that annual allocation, we lose it. And that's a bit of a contract approach that is more of past history of California, where the theory was if you don't put water to use in a particular year, then others should be able to use it. Well, we've gone through decades recognizing that that single year evaluations and maximizing single use of water in a single year is for decades gone by, and we have to do multi-year water resource planning now. And multi-year water resource planning means that we have to have storage. So I did a little illustration of the Lopez water supply contracts, because it's really just on paper that we need to make the changes in order to establish storage rights. The dam's already built. The costs are already being paid. It's there. And it's really the lack of storage in Lopez Dam is one of the reasons why our other water supplies, like state water, aren't being fully utilized, because we have to have local storage capacity to bring that water locally and be able to use it during the drought. Now, we do have storage in the state water system, just not locally. So that's one of the district's goals in 2019. We have submitted contract amendments to both the County of San Luis Obispo as well as the other neighboring agencies to propose some serious dialogue in 2019 on getting storage rights. Infrastructure is, though, the big issue that the Oceano CSD is really facing and are addressing in 2019 and through our resource plan here. And I put 31 up there because we've identified 31 projects that are necessary in order to address the deferred replacement of some of these old and antiquated lines. What happens is when the system gets old and antiquated, we end up chasing problems. And in summer of 2018, we had a major line break that went underneath the Oceano Lagoon completely fail. And so we did an emergency project. And what this illustration shows is a curved line down below here. And then the squiggly line is disappearing on me. But that curved line that goes underneath the cross-section of the lagoon is the path of the drilling rig. And it's called horizontal directional drilling because in sensitive environmental habitat, we can't get excavators out there anymore. We can't dig trenches. You know, we need to do things in an environmentally responsible way. And the technology utilized then is to take a drill rig and actually curve it up and underneath the lagoon so that we can stay out of environmental sensitive habitat. And the other thing that's amazing, it's less expensive. It's not only good for the environment, but it's good for the pocketbook. And it was an emergency project. So I have a couple pictures of that, and a lot of the rest of the presentation is really going to be pictures. So on the west side of the lagoon, near ex-director Colwell's house, is where the rig was set up, drills over to the east side of the lagoon, which is the right picture. And then after you drill through, you grab that pipe and you pull it back the other way. So this is a little bit more on the left side of a close-up of pulling that pipe back underneath the lagoon. And then the red circle, it's probably a little bit difficult to see, but in there is the existing tie-in point to the existing system that they had to drill to get to. And the accuracy of these horizontal drilling rigs to go underneath the lagoon to get to the depth that they need to get to, and then to pop up on the other side essentially exactly where you need to be able to match up to your existing pipelines is amazing. They put little detectors on the dunes, and they flew drones, and they were able to track where their drilling rig was going underground the whole time. Just absolutely amazing work. And it's that kind of technology, too, that it's cost-effective in this approach. You can't pull a single pipe. You have to, this is called fusion welding. Where they have a rig, it's kind of a heating type of a thing where, you know, our sticks of pipe come in about 20-foot lengths, so you got to bring in a whole bunch of them. We needed 400 feet of pipe, so essentially you know, fusion welding 20 of these together, getting it all set up before you start pulling it out. That's the welding machine. And then this is the bit. It's two-direction. One direction drills the hole from the west side. Then you turn it around, and you can see that big hole, and you grab the pipe, and you pull it back through the other way. And pretty time-efficient, cost-efficient, and it was a great job in order to get that water line replaced. Met all the requirements of the California Coastal Commission. We had state parks clearance. Everybody approved it. Really good success. Before I jump into the stormwater thing, though, again, I identified 31 different projects. We've got some handouts over there. In 2019, we're going to be getting into more details. We don't have the cost estimates on those yet because Cannon Associates, who's working on the plan, is refining those cost estimates. But we do know we're going to have a local cost, and we need to be addressing that in 2019. So also on infrastructure, what about capturing stormwater in order to recharge it in the groundwater basin? And I think one of the questions might have come about, when are we going to start seeing physical improvements? And this is a spot where, you know, physical improvements have been long overdue. This is Highway 1 and 13th Street, and anybody who's been in Oceano for any amount of time knows that when we get any amount of rain, we're going to see big to little to large to massive puddles of water in different locations. And the county did go out to bid on this project earlier. I think that Sarah might be speaking to it a little bit. They are going to be going back out to bid in early 2019. Needed to essentially address some contractor issues and some funding from the prior bidding round, but that's still front burner for the county in terms of alleviating that. But the question in our water resource reliability program is, how do we capture that water and get it back down into the groundwater basin? How do we do things like drainage swales on the roadsides rather than having the water go down the gutter and getting, you know, pushing it out? How do we capture it internal to the community? These are some pictures of other communities where they've done successful what are called low-impact development recharge efforts. This is an example where they were able to do a percolation basin, and by doing a little notch in the sidewalk, get the water to run off of the street and into the percolation area. A drainage swale that allows for recharge. And then these types of projects also provide beautification in the community, and that's one of the additional benefits of low-impact development. And so again, and of course, community livability and quality of life as well. Our poster boards also show what the efforts with Cannon. What the engineers first did is they identified where was the flow of stormwater on the streets and how did it move throughout the community in order to identify the best locations to do low-impact development stormwater recharge. So they've mapped the flows. And then they've identified a number of areas where the pictures that we saw could be potentially applied here in Oceano. 17th Street, some concepts on Warner and 15th Street, some illustrations by, and I always forget the name, it's one of our famous churches here, and how it might look. These type of concepts will require a lot of community involvement in going through and will require grant funding in order to implement. There's no two ways around that. Another concept is the potential of putting a recharge underneath the Oceano Elementary School. We have not initiated any dialogue with the elementary school yet, but those are pretty common types of projects we're seeing in different areas more and more. And so to wrap it up, the big issues in 2019 for infrastructure and funding plan will be to maximize grant revenues, minimize local costs. Those are unavoidable. And to the extent that there are some local costs, phasing in the priorities in order to spread that cost over multiple years. But we'll hope that everybody is going to be engaged in those details because, of course, they are going to have a community cost in order to move forward. And with that, I would also be glad to entertain any questions.
We need the really tough questions now.
Well, Mr. Edwards normally is good for that.
Yeah, I just saw the pipes. I know nowadays they don't use metal pipes, but they use like almost a fiberglass or woven pipe. What types are they using for that project you were showing?
So the project that went underneath the lagoon is an HDPE, so it's a different type of a plastic. You know, PVC is pretty common. It's more rigid. The HDPE is also sort of the stuff that you see out in ag fields, smaller, more flexible so that you can actually pull it and bend it. But it is a plastic type of a petroleum product.
And I think it lasts 100 years or so?
I hope so.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Ogren. I have just a couple quick questions. In terms of the district's water production, what percentage would you consider the loss to be on average?
We've been looking at our records in order to identify what our loss percentage is, and it's really tough to nail down. I'll use the number of approximately 15%, but we've had so many different factors going in to try and evaluate that. One is that some of the district's historical records are just not very good. The second is that as we've been replacing meters, we've been putting them in more accurate meters. And so the historical data, how much of it was because the water was being lost through leaky pipes versus how much of it was a calculation that wasn't right because our meters were not registering accurately. But generally speaking, my estimate is going to be roughly 15%. The American Water Works Association and some of the other industry leaders say a good system is going to be like at 7% or less. You're always going to have leaks. And we do have areas that don't really have any leaks. But again, we have 31 projects that we need to know to get to. Those 31 are contributing to leaks. Thankfully, we have a pretty significant water supply. So, you know, it hasn't really impacted the delivery or the service to customers. But there is a cost factor associated with leaky pipes. And there's a wastefulness of water associated with leaky pipes. And those need to be addressed.
My other questions are, one, you mentioned 31 infrastructure projects. Does that include the many of the leaking sewer collection pipes?
This is simply water resources. And so we do also have some what are called hot spots within the sewer system that we have a sewer system management plan that identifies where our problem areas are that we monitor on an ongoing basis. We go in and we flush the lines every year. This year, or in 2019, the board is also going to be seeking consultants to do a similar evaluation on sewer as to what we're doing on water right now.
And then lastly, you mentioned LID projects, and then you also mentioned Central Coast Blue and possible recharge or injection. Given that Oceano generally has fairly high groundwater throughout the community, where's the water going to go with these LID projects and the Central Coast Blue? Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Edwards. All really good questions. So the groundwater injection associated with any recycle or reclaimed water project really requires that the groundwater basin has to have capacity to put that water. And in our area, which we generally call the La Cienega Valley, but it's the water that's fed from Arroyo Grande Creek predominantly, it's a relatively shallow aquifer. So right now where we're having droughts and the groundwater is declining and there's a lot of pumping going on and we're concerned about the pumping that's going on the mesa and, you know, is the pumping on the mesa reducing the water that's flowing into our area? Part of the question is where's the capacity if we're in a drought and it's decreased, even though Oceano's water well levels are reasonably good, there is some capacity there. But Central Coast Blue is evaluating the entire area through Pismo, through Arroyo Grande, through Grover Beach, and through Oceano in order to identify the best areas of being able to put that in, inject that reclaimed water. And their strategies are really twofold. One is to do it along the ocean to increase groundwater levels in the ocean, along the ocean, and reduce the risk of seawater coming in. That's one strategy. The other strategy is to lay out the wells throughout the communities in close proximity to where we pull it out for pumping purposes and delivery. And, of course, you can't get those wastewater injection wells too close to the water extraction wells, at least not right now. The regulatory environment in California is shifting. We may see in the future where you can take reclaimed wastewater, directly put it into the drinking water system, which is the historical toilet to tap. And, of course, a lot of technologies have improved. Another option that we might see in the future is you use the same well to inject the clean, and again, reclaimed water is extremely clean, to inject it in at one point and be able to extract it out at the same point months later. Those two alternatives are not being looked at right now, so it's either seawater intrusion barrier or multiple locations throughout the various communities. And let's see, another question?
Well, this will, I think, maybe our last question before we go back to open sessions.
And ex-director Mary Lucy, welcome.
Thanks. First of all, I want to thank you for... First of all, I want to thank you very much for protecting our water resources. I know that others around us have not been as fortunate as to build their reserves in water, and so Oceano has, I think, done an excellent job at doing that. I want to try to swing this back to capturing stormwater runoff, and just bear with me for a minute. So we have several drainage basins around our town that when the storm water runs, right, those basins catch that water and it keeps it out of our neighborhoods. And the time I've been here, I've seen four basins be developed. And I watch them very closely because if we don't have those basins and that water is in our houses, it's in the affordable housing across the highway, it's a disaster, and we all know how Highway 1 gets. So those basins are really instrumental into the quality of our life. Now we have developers coming in and using them as landfills. They're filling these holes up that capture our storm runoff water with cement, rebar, construction material, whatever will go in the hole. And so now where is the water going to go? And I know that that is not an OCSD issue, but it is a county issue with several entities. So maybe you could speak to, like, some of us who are nervous about not having these basins have the ability to capture that water.
Certainly. I'm going to do my answer sort of in two part. One, to the specific fact that we know that there's a location in the community where one of the drainage basins currently is getting a lot of construction, concrete, demolition debris put into the basin. And as ex-director Lucy had mentioned, I have to be a little bit careful because that's not specifically part of the district's jurisdiction. But I have been in contact with the county. I have been in contact with the county's code enforcement, which is part of the county planning department, and they are looking into that situation. It's my understanding, based on conversations on Friday, that the activity is not permitted, and that's the only news that I really have on it. The second part of the answer, then, is that even though those types of issues are not within the Oceano CSD's jurisdiction, at least not directly, those are the type of issues that we do want to hear about, because we do want to help facilitate coordination with the County of San Luis Obispo, and sometimes we have overlapping jurisdiction. Sometimes the issue of working through difficult situations is really having the local community services district, you know, working with the county and then working with the property owner or whoever the individual is who needs to address the problem. You know, again, on that specific location, we have been in contact with the county and county code enforcement. They are following up on it. But again, in general, whether it's road paving issues or other types of issues, we want to encourage everybody to contact the community services district. Sometimes it's individuals of our board of directors who are on county committees that can help answer the questions best. But again, we want to make sure that we can help address those types of questions.
Any final burning questions for Pavo?
And with that, I think we're going to do the breakout and take a break from presentations for a little while and have everybody at the tables, you know, re-engage their tables and hope for some mingling and additional one-on-one discussions.
We had originally the plan to reconvene at 11:45, but if folks are up for it and somebody could tell me what time it is, we don't want to lose anyone, especially families. So
Maybe we could do it a little bit earlier than that, move it up 10 minutes to 11:35. So that'll give folks about 10 to 15 minutes right now to check out the vendors out front, take a break, visit the tables, and we'll see you in a little bit. Thank you.
To reintroduce John. John's the Supervisor, Energy Programs, County of San Luis Obispo, Department of Planning and Building. In managing the energy efficiency programs, they serve residential, government, and commercial structures, and John oversees the county's climate action plan and PACE financing. He is also leading a project funded by two state grants exploring the feasibility of zero net energy neighborhood and eco-district in Oceano, which I am going to eagerly listen to. John serves on the boards of the California Rural and Hard-to-Reach Working Group, the Local Government Sustainable Energy Coalition, and the San Luis Obispo County Green Business Program. Prior to working in energy in the public sector in California, he was a sustainability consultant in Vermont, working with cities, universities, and corporations. John has master's degrees in environmental science and policy, and in business administration, and let's give it up to John.
Thanks, Pavo. Good morning, everyone, and thanks again for making the time to come out on a Saturday. We appreciate it, and we hope you find value in learning about all the exciting and important work that's in progress or in the works here in the community. So my agenda this morning is pretty straightforward. I'm going to provide a high-level overview of a big program, the Tri-County Regional Energy Network, that's being launched in 2019, and of a project, the Zero Net Energy Neighborhood Study that Pavo just referenced, that's currently underway. I will also provide information on how you can learn more, provide feedback, and participate. For each topic, I'm going to focus on two things. What is it and what will it do or offer? And number two, who will it serve and how will it benefit the residents of Oceano? The Tri-County Regional Energy Network, or what we fondly refer to as 3CREN, is a partnership among three Central Coast local government agencies who are collaborating to design and deliver regional energy efficiency programs using ratepayer dollars. What are ratepayer dollars, you may ask? They come from a small surcharge that you all currently pay on your PG&E or SoCalGas utility bills each month. And their purpose is to support energy efficiency programs such as the one I'm about to explain. So, in long story short, they're your dollars, and we encourage you to take advantage of them as they come back to your community via programs like this. Regional energy networks, or RENs, are intended to fill gaps and provide services to customers who are currently underserved by existing investor-owned utility programs. These underserved customers are considered by the California Public Utilities Commission to be hard to reach. I'm going to explain what hard to reach means in a moment. But before I do that, I just wanted to point out, first of all, as I was looking for a map of the Central Coast, there's not a single map out there that just has the counties that this program is going to be offered in. They all include Monterey County. So this map is more of a service territory map, and it's a bit unique about this service territory in that it is served by three investor-owned utilities: Southern California Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Southern California Gas. So the Tri-County Regional Energy Network was authorized by the California Public Utilities Commission in 2018 to administer three programs: workforce education and training, codes and standards, and residential direct install for hard-to-reach customers. If you are a building professional, or someone in your family is, or you know somebody that is in the residential or commercial construction industry, please stop by our table afterwards. I'd love to talk to you more if you have any questions about how you or your firm might be able to participate in the codes and standards or workforce training programs. But for today, I'm going to focus more on the residential direct install program. I think it's a lot more relevant to the folks in the room. So as I promised, what is a hard-to-reach customer? I want to talk a little bit about that really quickly. And how does someone know if they will be eligible to participate or to be served by our residential direct install program? So I encourage you to think of it like a checklist with four options: geography, housing type, language, and income. And a requirement, essentially, that you need to check off two out of those four boxes in order to be eligible to participate in the program. The good news is that everyone in San Luis Obispo County automatically checks off the geography box because we are a rural county. So in order to participate, you as a homeowner, a renter in a single family, in a multifamily unit, would simply need to be qualified by one of these additional eligibility criteria. And if you come over the table, we can talk a little bit more specifically about what that means. But in the interest of not putting anyone to sleep, I'm going to keep moving. So now's the fun part. What exactly will this program do, and what will it offer customers in terms of service? In short, customers will have access to free and low-cost or no or co-pay, free and low-cost or co-pay energy efficiency upgrades. These upgrades will include things such as attic insulation and other types of insulation measures, duct sealing and other types of air sealing measures, and those two are examples of really the bread and butter of a good residential energy efficiency program. Most of the housing stock on the Central Coast, including the housing stock in the community of Oceano, was built before the California Energy Code, and most of our homes have insufficient or no insulation in them, and would be considerably improved in terms of energy efficiency, comfort, indoor air quality, and utility bill savings through insulation and air sealing. Two other measures that examples of measures that we would be able to provide or upgrades to your home, include LED lighting and tankless hot water heaters. I encourage you again to stop by our table to learn more about these specific energy efficiency upgrades and several others that we will be offering. I also want to point out that we hope to be able to partner in the implementation of this program with a very important community-based organization that we're lucky enough today to have in the room, CAPSLO. CAPSLO, as many of you know, already implement and offer residents in San Luis Obispo County access to income-qualified energy efficiency programs. We hope to work with them to sort of layer this on top of their existing portfolio of programs and be able to offer this to customers who may not be eligible for their existing programs but be eligible for the Tri-County Regional Energy Network and its residential direct install program. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about a study an exciting project taking place right now in the community of Oceano. And specifically, as this map indicates, it's in a specific neighborhood or area of Oceano between 17th and 24th Pike, and I'm from Vermont. I was told to say in California, the one. You guys put the in front of things out here. I like that. You're supposed to laugh. Okay, so the goal of this study, funded by a California Energy Commission grant, is to comprehensively understand the feasibility of achieving zero net energy, or ZNE, in a pilot neighborhood in Oceano. While the definition of ZNE for this study has not been fully determined, and we look to the community to help us determine it, Think of a zero net energy neighborhood as one that is both very energy efficient and one that produces as much renewable energy as it consumes energy in a year. I'm going to pause for a moment. Hopefully that makes sense. So if it doesn't, I hope through some more explanation it will. So this assessment is being done by one, determining the neighborhood's current energy consumption; two, determining how much the current energy use could be reduced through energy efficiency and conservation; three, determining how much renewable energy would be needed to meet the remaining energy use after energy efficiency and conservation; and four, thank you, doing lots of community outreach like this. So, I think I'm going to sound like a broken record. Please stop by our table. Introduce yourself to a gentleman by the name of Farhad, who traveled down from Oakland for today. He is our lead consultant on this project and an expert in energy efficiency, renewable energy, and zero net energy, and he's a good guy. He can answer all of your questions, if we can't, to learn more about this project, its status, and how you can participate. So, back to what it means for you. How might this study benefit residents of Oceano? Well, not to punt on the question, but that answer is exactly what this study is trying to answer. A couple potential benefits of the study could include free and low-cost energy efficiency upgrades, like the ones I conveniently mentioned are going to be made available in 2019 through the Tri-County Regional Energy Network. It's almost as if somebody had these two things in mind when they thought about them. And number two, if the community wanted it, the potential to create to create locally owned and generated renewable energy that could provide subscribers access to lower long-term utility bills and carbon-free energy. Another compelling aspect or goal of this project that I wanted to mention is replication. The California Energy Commission is very interested in this study insofar as it could be replicated both in other neighborhoods in San Luis Obispo County as well as to other neighborhoods throughout the state of California. So to learn more, to provide feedback, to participate, please visit our table during the open session that we have after these events, or contact me via email or phone, or use either one of these links to access information online. You'll notice that the top link for the Tri-County Regional Energy Network is one of the County of Ventura, because they are the lead agency on this effort. The bottom link is for the County of San Luis Obispo, because we are the lead agency on this zero net energy neighborhood study in Oceano. Thank you again.
Hi, I live in a mobile home park here in Oceano. Question one, would your energy upgrades apply to mobile homes as well as regular homes?
Yes, so long as the tenant or owner was qualified as an eligible customer, mobile homes are able to be served. I also want to point out that PG&E has a mobile homes program, and that CAPSLO, I believe, also is currently able to serve mobile home owners. So there's a variety of ways in which a mobile home owner or renter could be served.
Okay, and secondly, in my specific park, we pay the park manager or the park owner our electric bills, so we don't pay PG&E direct. So would that throw an iron in the works there?
I'm going to answer your question in two ways. One, you're hitting on one of the largest challenges anywhere in the world, but certainly here in California, for energy efficiency. It's called the split incentive, meaning the best interests of the renter or tenant are not necessarily the best interests of the landlord or owner. Because if you're renting and you pay the bill, you're automatically interested in energy efficiency because you want to spend less money, right? Mm-hmm. But if in that case, the owner is not paying the bill, so his or her prioritization of investing in energy efficiency may be different or lower than yours. In your case, it's adding some complexity to it. Let's take that offline, and we can talk about it further to understand how to do that. But in order for us to be successful in that scenario or in multifamily buildings, we ultimately need to be working both with tenants and owners or property managers.
Okay, we own our own homes.
Okay.
We own the mobile homes, but we have to pay space rent within the park. And again, our utilities are paid through the park, not directly to
okay.
utility
Thanks for
companies.
That clarification.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Any other questions? And seeing none, I think John gets to introduce our speakers from the San Luis Obispo County Public Works Department. Sir.
Shall I introduce both of you at the same time?
If Jill would like to come up.
She's going to speak. I'm going to be here in case there's a difficult question.
Okay. So I get the pleasure of introducing Sarah Crable and Jill Ogren. Sarah Crable is a water resources engineer for the Department of Public Works at the County of San Luis Obispo. She's been at the county for less than a year and has primarily worked in overseeing the development of the Stormwater Resources Plan.
Oh, you need to show the notes. You don't have a script?
A document that makes public agencies eligible for voter-approved grant funding for multi-benefit stormwater projects. Sarah previously was an agricultural engineer with the Irrigation Training and Research Center at Cal Poly, where she worked on modernization projects for irrigation districts with canal delivery systems. Sarah's interests include advancing wastewater and reclaimed water treatment, as well as removing the stigma that goes along with these important water resource strategies. Jill is a senior utilities engineer, also for the Department of Public Works at the County of San Luis Obispo. She's worked at the county for 32 years in a variety of capacities from construction and design to development services, and for the last 10 years has been responsible for water systems that the county currently maintains and operates, including the Lopez Reservoir and the Arroyo Grande Creek Flood Control Channel. More importantly, in her spare time, she enjoys baking and teaching fitness classes. Good morning and welcome, Sarah and Jill.
Okay, so I'm Sarah, water resources engineer. So I'm going to talk about some projects that we... Oh, darn.
I'm busy today.
Yeah, so I'm going to get to talk about projects that... are more of a highlight or the informative portion of these projects, so I won't get too detailed into them. But the first project that I'm going to talk about has to do with the Oceano Revitalization Plan that was adopted by the Board of Supervisors in 2013. And as part of that plan, there's... what we call an implementation plan, and it deals with improvements to Front Street, so which is our Highway 1, and that spans from 4th Street to 19th Street. And these improvements include assessing the pedestrian crossways or the crosswalks in those areas because they tend to be a little bit more angled, and that can pose difficulty with pose difficulty with cars turning around those corners at higher speeds. So that's a major point that we're going to try to assess. Oh, okay. Well, let's see what... Okay. And then who has... Okay. Sorry about this. So, this is just an overview of that project. So, here's our 4th Street through 19th Street. And it's going to be looking at these intersections and just trying to make them more safe for people to walk as well as to ride bikes there. And the overall goal of this is to have a more walkable community. So in the hopes of having a kind of like a downtown core area. Okay, so with this implementation plan that examines that map area that I showed previously, the community has been very involved in it, so that's appreciative for Public Works because you guys know what you guys want in those areas. And right now that plan is 30% complete, and it is on hold due to funding. So Public Works staff is waiting to hear back on a Caltrans grant. Paavo mentioned this. I think it's gonna. The results are gonna be available in January 2019. So we'll hear back and figure out if we can keep moving forward with that plan. And the point is, you know, once again, community development. And so we do want to move this plan forward at a minimum cost, you know, to your community. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about a more specific project that you guys can actually see now and you can actually drive over. So the Air Park Bridge, which is near this airport, next adjacent to these two RV campgrounds, it is almost done being constructed, if not already completely constructed. And it was a part of the county's bridge replacement and maintenance program. And it was a 1940s timber-built bridge. So now you guys have a concrete bridge. And some of the complaints from the community were that this walkway next to it, there were these large nails that would stick out and be a tripping hazard for people. So... now there's a very beautiful walkway that's safer for people on either side of the bridge. And then it was actually really noisy when people would drive over it. And so there's people camping in this area in the RV parks. So now it's a lot less noisy. And so this was about a $2 million project in construction cost. And Public Works staff was able to get this project constructed with grants from Caltrans, their highway bridge program. And the contractor is set to be out of the area in January 2019. They're just finalizing utility locations. And just as a side note, bridges are usually conduits for utility companies to get utilities from one area to another. So now there's a more substantial bridge for these utilities to be located. Okay, so the next project that I'm talking about is in the works. This is the Arroyo Grande Creek Channel. So the county maintains about 3 miles of the Arroyo Grande Creek. And this is a man-made channel that includes Los Barros Channel and Arroyo Grande Creek Channel. So if you have any questions, Jill will be at the table after. She really, really knows about this project. But I'm going to go over a couple highlights of it. So this channel was a man-made channel constructed in the 50s. And as you can see, it is just completely empty. It's just a dugout channel. And the main purpose of that channel was for flood protection. And over time, you know, as creeks flow, they carry a lot of sediment with them, soil, rocks. Over time, that channel has become a very overgrown creek with significant amounts of vegetation, trees. So this is the bridge right here. I have a picture over at our table over there, but this is the railroad crossing at 22nd Street. When this was constructed, there was 14 feet between the bottom of this bridge to the bottom of the channel. Currently, there is 5 feet. So 9 feet of that depth was lost due to sediment loading from the creek. So what does that mean? Why do we care about that? You know, wait, we have a creek now. Isn't that what we want, a beautiful creek in our area? Well, that means we have less capacity for flood control now. There's that much less area for water to be transmitted. So this is, maybe some of you guys recall this, but in 2001, this creek has two levees, or has a levee along the north and south side, but it was breached, meaning it just broke, and there was significant flooding. There had to be some evacuations in this area. And this is due to that sedimentation and that vegetation that is in that creek now. So a major challenge is, how do we maintain a creek, but also get back that really important point of this, which is the flood control. So the Arroyo Grande Waterway Creek Waterway Management Plan is currently going to be implemented. And there's going to be some construction that needs to occur and some removal of that sediment. So there's going to be the north and south levees that will be raised, as well as a flood control wall. Currently, we do sedimentation and vegetation management at the county, but this is going to be furthered. It's all been studied. So it's going to be a little bit more in depth of what we are able to do now. And it's what it's going to do is restore the channel to a 20-year flood protection to the residential areas on the north side, and then provide 10-year flood protection to those properties on the south side. The total cost for this project is going to be $16 million. They're hoping to, like I said, begin construction within the next 2 years. But currently, staff has been able to secure, through grants and loans, $8 million. So it's very important for us to continue seeking funding for this project, and that is one of Jill's main work products, is to continue applying for grants and loans to be able to get this project going. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about another project that we are trying to get underway, and this is the 13th Street Drainage Program, or Drainage Project. So I saw quite a few pictures of this in other presenters, but the flooding that happens regularly on 101, this is what this project is going to address. So we have 13th Street, and this flooding that occurs on 101, and we have the railroad right here, and then we have this RV park over in this area and AG Creek. So this project, once constructed, is going to provide inlets, so storm drain inlets, and there's going to be a pipeline, so a storm drain pipe, that carries that captured water, so keeping it off of 101 or Highway 1, and it's going to travel under Highway 1, under the railroad, and take it down this, I think it's Dolphin Avenue,
and to this sedimentation basin that's at the RV park. So it's going to allow sediment to settle out in that sedimentation basin and then slowly let the water be released into the creek. You know, so we recognize that this is a major concern in your community, and you know, we are doing everything we can to go forward with this. The construction cost for this is going to be about $4 million, and currently there's a USDA loan that is being sought by Public Works staff to make sure that we have that secured, and going forward with it, we're still, you know, getting all of those T's crossed, I's dotted, and we're going to be advertising for construction in January 2019, so just in a few months. And if we're following the schedule, get the USDA loan secured, it should start in May 2019, and it should take about 10 months, mind you, you know, if things change with the weather, but it's estimated to be complete in the following year of March 2020. Okay, so let's talk about the funding of these projects. How do we go about getting grant funding, meaning like how does Public Works staff go about it? How does the CSD go about this? And I'm going to talk about a project that I am most familiar with, which is the Stormwater Resource Plan. So a Stormwater Resource Plan is just a document that is required by the State Board from Senate Bill 985, and it has to do with making public agencies or nonprofits eligible for voter-approved grant funding. So if you have a project, or if a public agency has a project and they would like grant funding for that stormwater capture project, so this is specifically stormwater, that agency must fall in to a stormwater resource plan. So the county has chosen to participate in this voluntary program because we believe that stormwater is a resource, and we want people within the county to be eligible for funding for these stormwater capture projects. So I highlighted two projects today that where stormwater was a nuisance, but the State Board is choosing to look at stormwater, like I said, as a resource, and the county is choosing to do so. So there's a caveat to this, and these stormwater projects must meet multiple benefits. So there's that flood protection. Everyone knows that's what a stormwater project does, prevents flooding. But the other two, you have to meet at least two out of these five benefits. So water quality, water supply, flood management, environmental, or community. So it's really important when the community or a public agency is coming up with a stormwater project to address flooding that they frame a project to meet other benefits. So will this project help employ the community? Will it provide community jobs? Will this project help supplement the water supply? Does this project help clean up the water, so improve water quality? Does it help improve a water body and improve the environment? So this is something that is really important to keep a lookout for because it will make us eligible for grant funding. So we have two immediate proposition funding that are coming available soon. So Prop 1, Round 2 implementation, there's going to be $90 million statewide that is expected to be released in fall 2019. And then Prop 68, which was approved in June, there's about $500 million for flood protection. So if there's projects out there for stormwater, they have to be in the stormwater resource plan to be able to be eligible for these types of funding. And of course, you can still have a stormwater project, but it just may not be eligible for this particular funding. And it can be eligible for other grants and other loans, but I'm just speaking about voter-approved Prop 1 and Prop 68. So with that, I'm just hoping that you guys, if you have any questions, you can come talk to us. But we are working to do some stuff in your community, and it's important that you guys provide feedback. So we appreciate you guys being here today. It is really helpful for us. Uh-oh.
Very beginning of your presentation, you said that the revitalization plan has been completed, 30%?
Yes.
I haven't seen anything. I don't understand what you mean by this. Can you please explain?
Okay, so a plan just is a document. So the document and the development of that document is 30% complete.
The development of the document, not
yeah,
the actual
so
thing.
As far as the construction of the items in the revitalization plan, that can't happen until the actual plan is complete, and then there's contracts that go on with that. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Will you include the crosswalk through across Highway 1?
I do not know that. There is someone that we work with who works on this specifically,
okay.
So he would be the best person to talk to.
Okay,
we can get you in contact with him. Or
and for the levees and the creek, do you think we could have a bike path on the new levees or like a Bob Jones trail for the South County?
Jill Ogren, that's a great question, and it's something we sort of struggle with. Currently, if you've been down by the Rio Grande Creek levees, you will notice that there are people bicycling and walking dogs. It's actually not a public trail, but that is definitely something maybe out in the future that could be considered to make that more of a public place. At the moment, the county simply has easements across all that property. So that is not, it's technically private property. And if somebody, you know, the residents are considerate enough to not really do anything about it, so people do use it, but it actually is not a public trail. But at some future date, it absolutely could be. There won't actually be new levees. Part of the project is just to raise them simply, not by a lot. We have to stay within the easement. And so, that's definitely on the book somewhere, probably further out. Right now, the focus is balancing what we need for flood protection with the needs of the creek and the habitat.
Thank you.
Hi there, Rio Cortes. I was wondering about with the stormwater that comes across 13th Street, it's like the flooding zone right there, which basically shuts down Highway 1 if there's a major rainstorm every single time. So you're saying that water is there, because they were going to try to put some kind of flood, you know, thing going across that 13th Street crossing somewhere there, but it sounds like you guys are going to go further down between like 13th and 15th somewhere to do the stormwater. Where are you going to send that water to?
So, good question. We're basically giving it a way to get to the Rio Grande Creek. So what happens is they'll have, right now there's no drainage inlets to capture that water as it comes down to Highway 1 and along Highway 1. So there'll be a number of drainage inlets installed that will collect the water, take it in a single pipe all the way down, I think it is Dolphin Avenue, to a sedimentation basin, which will be adjacent to the Rio Grande Creek. And that's where it will sit until such time as the Rio Grande Creek is low enough to let the water out. And in situations where, you know, during the storm when the level in the creek is high, that basin will fill up. And then over time, there is a little place for it to overtop if for some reason the creek does not lower quick enough to let the water out.
Nice, thank you. And then the other question I had was about the vegetation management down in the creek. I mean, now we have these nice trees or whatever that are, in a lot of ways, those trees are holding the levee in place. So I'm just hoping they don't remove the trees altogether. But, I mean, I know they thin them out and, you know, chip them up and stuff, and that's all good. I'm just hoping they don't remove those trees for the salmon and all the, you know, wildlife down there.
Right, and that is exactly the project is, it's dual. So it does, we need to create shade. Well, there'll be a canopy. We're calling it a buffer zone. So there is kind of a low flow channel if you've ever walked or seen it. That is preserved. There'll be like 10 to 15 feet on each side in which no vegetation would be removed. The outer areas, that's where we would keep that as sort of the flood area. But yes, where you have at least two endangered or threatened species there, which is the salmon and the red-legged frog, along with there's even a, it's also habitat for certain birds. So it's, and oh, the snowy plover is down at the dunes, and that's actually state parks territory. That's where they're at, and they have to do all their measures to protect them. Within the creek channel, though, we know of, there are some western pond turtles. They've got, the red-legged frog and the salmon, and the steelhead. So that is that's one focus in this project. And as Sarah was talking about all the different fundings, so she mentioned that there's this Prop 68 and Proposition 1. So to make up the shortfall for that for the project on Arroyo Grande Creek, we will also be going for that because it shows multiple benefits, right? It's environmental, it's taking care of the stormwater. So it's a, and having the local hazard mitigation plan that we talked about earlier, along with the stormwater resources plan, these are all boxes that have to be checked off when you go for a grant. It makes you more eligible. So your community and all that you're doing is really setting yourselves up so that you are more likely to be eligible and for this funding. So it's all very good.
I thought of another question. I've lived here a long time, and I know where the flooding happens. It doesn't happen just on Highway 1. It also happens in the industrial area, and I don't know what that is called. That from there goes to the beach. Mm-hmm. It's Beach Street, where all the sheds, the vegetable stands are, and then it floods on behind them, because basically where the airport is now, it used to be a flood zone. Mm-hmm. So to me, to think about taking care of the flooding problem in that area without questioning the presence of miles of asphalt on top of the soil seems ludicrous. So I wonder if in your plan, or at least in your head, you have ever thought about the role of the airport in the flooding problem of that area of our county. And if have you ever questioned the presence of the airport?
I can't say that I haven't questioned it, but I would say that it's been there for a long time, and some of what happens in a community is things were there before there was even a thought that there might ever be a problem. It is kind of odd that Oceano is built in basically the lowest spot you could possibly think of. It's got a huge, two very large watersheds that drain, and it all eventually makes its way to Oceano. I don't really know when the airport was built, how much was thought. Maybe there wasn't a lot of development. Pablo, do you know when it was built? Maybe 80s, 70s, 60s?
I'm not, but Jeff Edwards might still be here. He tends to be one of our local experts on the, you know, the issue with the airport, of course, is it's in a low-lying area, and part of these strategies are in order to control the flood water before they get down there. And so when we speak about streets and pavement, when I spoke earlier about the low-impact development and how do we evaluate where the stormwater is coming down the streets and where we might be able to capture it in order to get back into the groundwater basin, that type of a project will help reduce the amount of stormwater gets to Highway 1 and 13th Street and will help reduce the amount of stormwater that gets into the airport area. And to follow up on the question from the gentleman, you know, it's at the corner of 13th and Highway 1 is where one of the major drainage inlets will be. So it's really, especially in an area, you know, Oceano was originally subdivided in the 1800s. And like a lot of the other coastal communities, there was no land use planning associated with those subdivision. The trivia question I like to ask is why do we have 80-foot road widths in Oceano and Los Osos and others? And the answer is because they drew it on the maps wide enough so the horse and buggy can make a U-turn. A lot of times people have now incorporated some of that into their front yards. But yeah, through these multiple strategies that we talk about with stormwater resources, some of it is the low-impact development strategies to rework the roads and the streets. Can we get some underground recharge underneath the playfield at Oceano Elementary? Other aspects are capturing the water where it, when it does get down to Highway 1, and just trying to do the combination of efforts in order to do the best to reduce the flooding. And my question for Sarah is that you're not forgetting about our LID project in your stormwater resources plan, right? Because we need to be able to chase that grant money for Oceano for our LID and beautification. You don't have to answer it because I know it's in there.
Okay.
Bonnie, did you have a question?
Hopefully it's just a quick question. At the end of where the Arroyo Grande Channel goes into the ocean, I assume that's where we have county land versus state parks land. I've heard the rumor that state parks prohibits clearing of the mouth of that channel, and that's one thing that contributes to flooding is backup. Is that, I don't know if that's true.
It's a good question. So the state parks is, that is their land. And they do have a policy, which sort of makes sense, is that they like to let things be as they are, leave them natural. To go in there and to manually, you know, breach the sandbar to let it is counter to what their policies are. So I guess the answer is they would not like that to happen. Whether they actually go forward and prevent it is, I don't know that that's necessarily true. But that's, it's counter to their policy. And they have to be in charge of the snowy plover. Right?
Now, I can follow up a little bit, too, in part based on my vast experience on the flood control. And I showed the project that we did to go underneath Oceano Lagoon for our replacement, which was going on State Walk Parks property. And if we can get all the permits lined up, then they're definitely going to be, well, their basic thing is you we have to get all the permits lined up. If we get all the permits lined up, then generally speaking, at that point in time, they're going to give us the right of entry to do the work. But the permitting issue is always a bigger challenge and everything. So I agree with Jill's statements that their general policy from state parks is just to let things be and let nature do its thing. The challenge here is where we have an urban, you know, a community, and we have this urban and wildlife interface, how do we address it? Because that's really where, you know, human development and the natural environment come together. And it's really, that's a big part of the public works job. And what they have to do at County Public Works is take a look at the interface between human infrastructure and the natural environment and try to make that interface as best as possible for all. So my experience with state parks is once we get all the permits lined up, then they usually come along. I got nervous on our emergency project because we got everything lined up and I had the contractor ready to go and I was knocking on state parks' door for the right of access, and we got it in time. I'm talking a couple hours in time, not days or weeks, but it was there. Some more questions?
First of all, thank you very much. Every time I drive by the levee and I see, you know, activity going on,
it makes me smile, whether it's the goats or out there laying the plastic and the straw. So a lot of us do notice. Thank you very much. And I know this isn't in your jurisdiction either, of human services and social services, but we have more than just, you know, wildlife living down in the creek. And it's kind of like, you know, the elephant in the room, and we don't quite know how to address it, and we don't want to address it in a calloused, uncaring way, but it has to be addressed. And not just that there's human life down there, but there's a tremendous amount of debris, you know. So do you plan for things like that, or how would that be handled?
So we've regularly, and I don't know if what exactly has changed, but I've been working on this creek for at least since 2009, and I would say that probably in the last 3 to 4 years there's been an unusual amount of trash and the homeless population down there. So prior to 3 or 4 years ago, once a year, as part of our vegetation maintenance, was cleaning out random, you know, trash. In the last couple of years, we actually had to set up a separate budget because it doesn't really feel fair for just the people in Zone 11A to pay for this trash. So there's actually a countywide trash budget, of which we've used a significant amount each year. We've, in fact, just Friday, we removed another big bunch of trash. And we do this usually prior to storms, because it's really, it not only is it not good for the creek, but once you get water in there, and then that becomes debris at bridges, and it can cause flooding in and of itself. So we are doing more regular trash removal. It is just a problem. We think about this. I know there's a countywide group that is just trying to figure out how to address what's happening in the creeks with this kind of thing. And there doesn't seem to be a really good, easy answer at this time. But it's not healthy for the creeks, and so we are doing as what we can with the money that we have to do it. But it's quite expensive, and because of the nature of some of the trash, it requires special hazmat. You know, not every, it's hard to find a contractor that will come in and do it. So it's not
and
great.
Jill, if I can follow up with your answer a little bit, because again, the county through Public Works has the primary responsibility within the creek itself. But this is also one of the areas of overlapping jurisdiction, because Oceano CSD, we do have the garbage power through, and we work with Waste Connections, Inc. They are the actual service provider. But out of the garbage rates that you pay every month, the district gets about 10% of that back. The board has approved, and we're hiring an individual who will dedicate half of their time on working on the waste issues throughout the community, whether it's the illegal dumping in the alleyways. And also last year, the board of directors adopted a number of different policies that, whether it's on your street or in your alleyways or working with the county in cleaning up the creek, we have programs that are set up, and what they really require is community advocates. Most recently on, I guess, Earth Day or Coastal Cleanup Day, the Oceano Beach Community Association was the first one to come in with an application, where they organized a group of volunteers on Creek Cleanup Day, on Beach Cleanup Day, and the CSD came in, and we had the large roll-off boxes there and coordinated the efforts in order to help with those cleanup events. And that's a pretty common event throughout the county and really throughout the state for cleanup efforts. But it's not the only way that we can help. So we do have the program set up. We are hiring the staff. And again, whether it's in, you know, your portion of the neighborhood or wherever, there's a number of things that the district can support, and it really requires advocacy from within the community and lining up some volunteers. But you don't have to have a lot of volunteers. It can just be, you know, a number of your neighbors. In fact, last meeting, an individual was talking about the illegal dumping that's occurring by their house, and so we're going to hopefully help set up a program for that particular alleyway as well. And not sure if there's any other questions. I know we have our final speaker who's here, and I'm ready to start introducing him. Any last quick question for Sarah or Jill? Yes.
Quick question. I know a few, getting back to the 13th Street flooding, I believe, if I'm correct, a few years back they were talking about putting, well, let me back up, your proposed intakes for 13th Street. I think a few years ago there was talk of running drainage underneath Highway 1, but there was a snag with railroad property, and they couldn't get access through the railroad people. And I think I'm correct on that, but I may not be. But anyway, have you considered getting permissions from the railroad people for the intake project?
Yes, and we've gotten it. There will be, as Pablo was talking about, that directional drilling. It will be similar to take it underneath the railroad. And that's where the pipe will go under the railroad, and that's how we'll get it down towards the creek to the basin.
Okay, thank you.
Again, thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Jill. We appreciate you coming out. Well, I have to say, Ben's one of my favorite individuals to work with. He's super smart. Ben is the Director of Public Works and the City Engineer for the City of Pismo Beach, and he's been the Director of Public Works for the city since 2013. He's responsible for management, maintenance, and construction of the water and wastewater systems and maintenance and construction of all public infrastructure, including parks, water and sewer infrastructure, as well as streets and public building. Ben holds master's degree in mechanical engineering and business administration, as well as a bachelor's degree in agricultural engineering. He is a licensed civil engineer in the state of California with over 16 years of private sector and municipal engineering and management experience, as well as 7 years of teaching experience at the university level. And I wish I had enough time to get into a lot of Ben's efforts. He's extremely good-humored. He's good to work with. A visionary, and what he's going to be speaking about today is Central Coast Blue. Central Coast Blue is the proposed reclaimed water project, and it's really going to be involving two different wastewater flows. The city of Pismo Beach has their own wastewater treatment facilities, and then South County Sanitation District treats the wastewater for Oceano, Arroyo Grande, and Grover Beach at the Sanitation District's treatment plants next to the airport. Wastewater flows from both of the facilities join up for an ocean outfall that is a single ocean outfall. And so the opportunity is, since all the pipes kind of come into a central location, how can a project be developed to take the treated wastewater to a higher level so that it can be injected into the groundwater? I might end up covering Ben's presentation for him, and then he can correct me on my errors. It won't open?
It won't open.
I tested it twice.
Oh, no.
I don't have another laptop.
Does anybody need to get up and stretch? Why don't you guys get up and stretch? If you need to use the restroom real quick, and I'm going to see if I can get this presentation fixed. If not, I will give the talk without the slides. And I tried it on a different computer than I downloaded it on, and it worked, and we showed up, and it didn't. So I apologize. But thank you for having me. Thank you, OCSD and the county, for putting this on, and I'm honored to be here and talk to you today about Central Coast Blue. Were you guys paying attention during the last presentation? What does Jill like to do in her spare time? Bake, yes. And she actually chairs the Zone 3 technical advisory committees, and every month she brings a new baked treat. Was it Sarah or Sierra? Sarah, sorry. What did Sarah major in? Or what was her last job? Ag engineering. Woo, go ag engineers. I myself am an ag engineer.
All right.
Thank you for being patient. I am going to talk to you today about Central Coast Blue. The historic drought has highlighted the vulnerabilities in the city of Pismo Beach and neighboring agencies' water supply portfolios. The city of Pismo Beach, as well as Oceano, rely on state water, Lake Lopez water, and groundwater. The city of Pismo Beach took a lead to create a new recycled water supply. Our urban water management plan identified the need for recycled water, and the city received a recycled water facilities planning grant in August of 2012. The city council adopted the recycled water facilities planning study in April of 2015. Prior to that point, the city had been moving towards a tertiary upgrade to our wastewater treatment plant, and that would provide non-potable irrigation water, which would provide potable water offsets. As we completed the recycled water facilities planning study, we found that doing a full advanced treatment project with direct groundwater injection for potable reuse actually turned out to be cheaper by about half. You can see here the tertiary treated water was about $5,400 an acre feet, and the full advanced treatment is about $2,800 an acre foot. As we started moving towards the end goal of recycled water, we ran into a few forks in the road. Actually, there was multiple forks. We have a shared groundwater basin. The basin is adjudicated, and we manage it through the NCMA, or Northern Cities Management Area, which includes Aurora Grande, Grover Beach, Oceano, and Pismo Beach. The city's wells are actually located outside the city of Pismo. They're in the city of Grover Beach. We have flooding concerns at our wastewater treatment plant, and we also have shared infrastructure with the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitary District. We have a shared outfall. So we partnered with our neighbor agencies to come up with a regional project with regional benefits. The city of Pismo Beach, Grover Beach, Aurora Grande, the Oceano Community Services District, and the South County Sand District. If you're unfamiliar with where they're geographically located, now you know. As we were doing this, the city of Aurora Grande and the South County Sanitary District was also completing their recycled water facilities planning study, and that analysis really pointed towards the same type of project. When you look at the infrastructure required to get the water into the ground, this kind of shows here potential well sites. So these circles are municipal and production wells. And then these little nodes here are potential production wells for recycled water. And when you look at the infrastructure required, all this piping that needs to be put in to do one project, and then we're going to do another project with similar infrastructure, really didn't make sense. This here just shows what the advanced treatment train looks like. There's microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and ultraviolet. So we partnered with the other agencies, Aurora Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceano, and rebranded the project. It started out as the City of Pismo Beach Recycled Water Project. We rebranded it as the Regional Groundwater RGSP, Regional Groundwater Sustainability Project, which really didn't mean anything to anybody. And then we rebranded it again as Central Coast Blue. We really wanted to identify with the community. My previous presentation had slides about this. I don't know if this one does. Looking at some of our successes to date, we have a 50-50 cost share agreement for the EIR with the City of Pismo Beach and the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitary District. I'm going to refer to them from now on as the Sand District because that's too much to say. The Sand District ratepayers are Aurora Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceano. So this is a true partnership of all the agencies involved to complete the EIR. We're also working on a ground model, and that ground water model is being funded by the County of San Luis Obispo, the Sand District, and the City of Pismo Beach. And this is just a little snapshot out of that model. We're expecting the model to be completed in the first quarter of next year. And that'll really help us understand how the water could be stored within the basin and how the water moves throughout the basin and even between the Northern Cities Management Area and the Napomo Mesa Management Area. The groundwater model will actually model the entire basin within San Luis County. So that's from Pismo Beach all the way to the Santa Maria River. The preliminary engineering is being divided between the City of Pismo Beach for Phase 1. As Pablo mentioned earlier, the city has its own wastewater treatment plant, and then the Sand District provides wastewater services for Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Oceano. This project will be a two-phase project. The first phase of the project will treat and inject the effluent from the City of Pismo Beach's wastewater treatment plant. Well, the Sand District does some upgrades to their plant, and when they finish, we'll proceed with Phase 2, which will treat and inject the water from the other agencies. So the City of Pismo Beach is funding the preliminary engineering for Phase 1, and the cities of Grover Beach and Arroyo Grande are funding the preliminary engineering related to Phase 2. We recently received a $2 million planning grant. That was a Prop 1 planning grant. And this will help to fund a test injection well, and we'll be able to actually pump. We'll take potable water, pump it into the groundwater basin, and actually see how the basin reacts to the water. People have asked, why spend all this money on a test well? Well, it's a good question, and the answer is, one, we want to see how the basin reacts, but two, it will be used as one of the injection wells once the project's finished. We'll also use this money to update our monitoring plan, the basin level response plan, a leaching study, and we're also doing an offshore aerogeophysical analysis, which is going to be super cool. They're going to take a helicopter, and there's this array of magnets that they fly over the coast, and they're able to measure the density of the water. So this is actually one that they did in Northern California, and you can see fresh where the salt water here is heavier, and then the fresh water. So that'll actually help us to know where the interface is between the fresh water and the salt water. And we can see one of the things that we're concerned about, and one of the reasons why we're so anxious to get this project done, is we're worried about salt water intrusion. We don't know where that interface between fresh water and salt water is. We have an idea, but the only way we can really know where it is when the salt water hits one of our monitoring wells. So this will help us to really know where that interface is. And then we actually, presentation is a little bit outdated. We were hoping to get a Prop 1 implementation grant, and we just found out Friday that we didn't. Unfortunately, we will reapply for the next round, which is in 2020. So all of this that we have discussed, and actually here's one of the slides I thought I was going to have, but I didn't, now brings us to this new venture, Central Coast Blue. Central Coast Blue will provide sustainable water supplies. 30% of the existing demand by the agencies could be met through Central Coast Blue. It'll put beneficial use of recycled water and reduce ocean water discharge by 77%. So right now, Pismo Beach and the Sand District have a shared outfall. 77% of that water being discharged to the ocean will be captured and injected into the groundwater basin. So these five agencies, Pismo Beach, Arroyo Grande, Oceano, Grover Beach, and the Sand District, are managing our water collaboratively and holistically to help create lasting water independence. Here is a time frame of where we hope to be. Currently, right now, we're working on preliminary design, technology piloting, the EIR, and community connection, stuff like this. Next year, we'll move into design of Phase 1 and permitting of the advanced treatment and the test injection well. And in 2020, we hope to complete Phase 1 design and permitting and then kick off construction in 2021 for Phase 1 and work on the design for Phase 2. And in 2022, we hope to begin operations for Phase 1 and have a groundbreaking for Phase 2 and be one step closer to water independence. There is currently a recycled water demonstration facility, or pilot plant, that is located at the City of Pismo Beach Wastewater Treatment Plant. It was very generously donated by IDE, Israeli Desal Engineers. They're one of the largest desal companies in the world, and they want to get in the recycled water market. They approached us through one of our consultants, Carollo Engineering, and said, hey, how would you guys like to partner with this? We'll provide the equipment, you help run it. We said, great. So this is allowing us to test the technologies, the microfiltration, the RO, and the UV process. It's also allowing us to gather a lot of data that we'll use in the design of the project. One of the most important aspects of the demonstration facility is it allows the community to come out and take a tour and see it and actually drink the water. One of the things, and unfortunately I have this in my other presentation, when we give tours, I have two cups of water, one labeled A and one labeled B, and everybody drinks the water, and then I have them vote on which one they think is tap water and which one they think is recycled water, and then I have them vote on which one they think tastes better, cup A or cup B. Almost 70% of the people think that the recycled water tastes better than City of Pismo Beach tap water, which is pretty remarkable. So what we're hoping to gain through the demonstration facility is acceptance. The demonstration facility promotes regional stakeholder engagement. The demonstration itself, performance testing, and then optimization, it'll allow us to optimize the design process. So that concludes this presentation. The other one had a couple more slides, but does anybody have any questions? Yes. So the question is, where will the injection wells be? And we're still working on that. We have a couple different consultants. Cleve Harris, geologist, is one. We're waiting for the outcome of this model to see how the groundwater is how the groundwater basin is predicted to react before we actually site the locations. And another consideration is there public property available at those locations, or do we need to purchase property?
Ben, there was a question from earlier that I want to pose, but the individual left. But also, did you drink the water?
I drank the water.
Okay. Wanted to check that first.
And I like it better than the tap water.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to tell you a funny story. We gave a tour to Shell Beach Elementary School third graders. My daughter happens to be a Shell Beach Elementary School third grader. And the night before the tour, I said to her, sweetheart, are you going to drink the water? And she said, well, I'm a little nervous. And I said, well, why are you nervous? She goes, Daddy, you said there's going to be two cups. And I said, yeah. And she goes, and Daddy, you said I'm not going to know which one's tap water and which one's recycled water. I said, no, you're right. And she goes, Daddy, I don't want to drink the tap water.
Very good. And I also assume that if we get a bunch of people from Oceano, you'll give us a tour.
Absolutely. The plant will be here for about another 2 months. So if you guys want to coordinate through Pavo or his office, we can absolutely set up a tour and bring in, show you the plant, and you can come drink the water. You had a question about...
Well, the question from earlier was, with groundwater levels near the coast, how do you know that there's enough room in the basin to put this recycled water?
That's a great question, and that's one of the things that this groundwater model will help us to determine.
And then where we're...
Up here, up front.
Lucia.
Excuse me, maybe because of the beginning it was a bit confusing with the presentation. Are you a private enterprise? Or I didn't understand really who you are. What is this... Are you a public agency?
That
are
is a
you?
Great question. I am the Director of Public Works for the City of Pismo Beach.
Okay.
And the City of Pismo Beach is the lead agency for the regional project that Oceano, Grover Beach, Arroyo Grande, and the Sand District, and the county, are all participating and collaborating with together. So it is a public enterprise of five different agencies working together to develop this project, which right now we anticipate constructing at the Sand District's wastewater treatment plant.
Got it. So, and this Coast Blue, what is the name of it?
Central Coast Blue.
Oh, it's the name of this project.
Correct.
Not as much of an agency of anything.
Correct.
It's the project.
The project
And the project basically is recycling water.
Correct.
Oh, finally, I got it.
Didn't need the PowerPoint.
Can't be any better. So,
other questions? Sarah, were you raising your hand back there? Oh.
Oh, Sarah. Who else is drinking the water? I haven't done it yet.
Jill, Jill left. Jill drank
Sarah
the water.
Did it. And do you make your treats, Jill, with recycled water, or is it still tap water? Okay. Bonnie?
We had a few representatives or people that were involved with the Coastal Commission here like a month ago, and I remember there was a bit of talk about moving the plant at some point, not in the near future, but in the distant future. And how does that affect all this?
So I'm not an expert, obviously, on the Sand District's business. I do know that they, when they did their redundancy project, one of the things, when they went to the Coastal Commission, one of the concerns was, is these five agencies aren't going to invest $30 million on a site where we can only be located for 5 or 6 years. So the Coastal Commission actually gave them 30 years. When they went for the redundancy project. One of our city council members is a coastal commissioner, and through talking with him, I do know that the commission and their staff is very supportive of the project.
And, you know, the question relates to also the relationship with the sanitation district recent project. They recently were permitted for what they call the redundancy project, which is upgrading their existing wastewater treatment, and it's been mentioned the Coastal Commission gave them a 30-year permit on that. The primary concern, of course, is climate change and rising sea levels. And as part of the sanitation district's conditions from the Coastal Commission is to put in some additional berms. I don't know how they're going to design them, but essentially additional flood protection around the sanitation district property. We know that there was a significant flooding event in 2010. So that project has gone through a lot of scrutiny in terms of climate change and sea level rise analysis. And they've identified mitigation measures in order to protect the site. But certainly, in the very, very long future, most everybody is anticipating, and we're, you know, whether it's 30 years or 50 years, you know, retreating off the coast is going to be important. In some of the debates up in Morro Bay, where actions have already been taken to with what is called coastal retreat policies and forcing Morro Bay to move away, some of the individuals in Morro Bay try to point back to the sanitation district's recent permit to continue to operate, and it's really kind of an apples and oranges. The Morro Bay has to do a complete rebuild. The sanitation district's is an upgrade. And even Central Coast Blue and the type of facilities we're talking about, they're more portable. Their treatment change, they can, you know, in a worst-case scenario, they can be moved. Of course, that's not anticipated. But all the same types of hoops that the sanitation district needed to jump through their permitting process, Central Coast Blue is going to have to go through those permitting steps. But again, since the Sand District already led the way on their project, a lot of those questions have already been asked and answered. And so we're pretty optimistic about being able to use the site.
Are there other questions? None? Well, I really appreciate you guys having me. One of the biggest challenges in a project such as this, working with five different agencies, is the agency collaboration. And I think we are all very fortunate to live in an area where that has actually been one of the easier aspects. Many of the councils and boards involved all together cannot agree that necessarily the sky is blue, but they all agree that this is the right project for this community and are very supportive. So thank you again for having me, and if you want to come see it, work through Pavo.
Thanks, Ben. Again, thanks everybody for coming out. We're still going to have a little bit of time to mingle with our different tables. This Central Coast Blue does wrap up our presentations for today. I want to reiterate my appreciation. And in 2019, everybody who lives and resides in Oceano is going to get additional information from Oceano CSD as we're developing some of our funding and project plans. And John, do you have any wrap-up comments as well?
All I want to say is thank you very much again to attendees, to all the folks who had tables and participated in that way, giving out outreach information, and to all of our speakers. Thank you very much. If we can just give a round of applause. Thank you, Pavo. I hope you all have a great rest of your day Saturday. Thank you.
Thanks, John. And a great holiday season.